So welcome everyone to today's final lecture in our series, Guastavino in Pittsburgh. The syllabus I handed out at the start of in the first lecture has included a short little self-guided tour of just a handful of Guastavino's works in Pittsburgh, if you're interested. These eight in particular, I think, are good representative examples, but also the nature of the course that we've been looking at here kind of breaks down into kind of four groups: architectural innovations, engineering innovations, ornament innovations that we're going to be looking at here today, as well as building science innovations. And so those four different groups, these eight samples here, there's two from each, as well as just in general, these are some of his better examples. So if you only have time to check out a handful, these are the ones that would be worth taking a look at. In addition, the syllabus has a complete list of all the buildings that we kind of covered in this course, as well as all the details as far as the architects, the dates, locations, that kind of thing. If you don't have a syllabus and you would like a copy, just send me an email and I can get it to you. So after arriving in the U.S. in 1881, Guastavino, his first, if you recall back from one of our earlier lectures, his first attempt at a development for tenement housing in New York City failed as a result of having some legal issues with the land rights. This was in New York City in 1883, just a couple of years after he arrived. So after this venture failed, he found himself almost penniless. So he reached out to some editors of a new magazine that had started circulating. The name of the magazine was Decorator and Furnisher. And he reached out to them to make drawings of furniture as well as interior decorations in the Spanish Renaissance style, the style that he was bringing over from Barcelona, Valencia. And the editors of this new magazine were seeking out content that was eye-catching, appealing, something new and different, which is certainly what he was bringing over to the Americas. And so he ended up being a very regular contributor to this magazine. In this circulation, he was noticed by an architect in particular that asked him to submit designs for a competition for this progressive club in New York City that was looking to build a new location. And so he submitted an entry, ended up winning the competition and winning the commission for this building that we're seeing here on the right, which was his first big break. Following that, a few years later, in 1889, he was introduced to Charles McKim of McKim, Mead & White, the architectural firm. And in this introduction, he was offered the contract to provide fireproofing for the Boston Public Library, which we're seeing here, his vaults over top. And this was the first instance here in the United States of using these Spanish tile vaults exposed as a finished material. This was a departure from what was traditionally done back in Spain, where it's generally covered over with a plaster and decorated with finished materials. And so this is where what we're looking at here today, as far as the ornamentation of his structural tiles. This is kind of where it started. So in a few years after the Boston Public Library, his His commissions were improving. His name was getting out there as a result of the Boston Public Library. It was quite a large commission, had quite a bit of exposure. But in February of 1894, one of the general contractors that he was working for defaulted on a payment to pay for Guastavino's work. And as a result of this, Guastavino himself didn't have the funds to be able to make payment on his own loans that he had taken out for materials and labor and these types of things for his projects. And this forced him into bankruptcy. So following this bankruptcy, he accepted a commission from the Vanderbilts to go down to North Carolina, the Black Mountains, to work on the Biltmore Estate that was being constructed at the time. And this was an opportunity for him to get out of town up in New England, to get away from this bankruptcy, so that way he could try to kind of start anew, so to speak. We're seeing here the exterior loggia of the estate and his tile that is being used on the exterior. And you also see some here, in particular, the flecking that is done on these certain tiles that are being burnished in the firing. And he's using them stylistically in the feel of the tiles just to create some aesthetic appeal. So when he did go down to North Carolina, he left his son at that point in charge of the business up in New York and Boston primarily, but they also had commissions elsewhere throughout New England. And so as he was down in North Carolina, as well as New England, by 1898, a lot of the work that they were performing was slowing down, or even at sometimes projects would come to a standstill as a result of problems with the tile manufacturers that are supplying the tile material for him to construct with. And a lot of these faults that they had related to providing tiles was a result of these manufacturers not having the ability to control the kiln temperatures that they're firing in, and as a result, not having a consistency with the firing of the clay would affect the results of the tile as far as the coloration, the texture, the density, the quality of the tile, generally speaking, to the point where quite a few of the tiles would end up getting rejected by Guastavino as far as in his mind being substandard. And so they decided between him and his son that maybe they should get into the tile making business and make tiles themselves so that way they could control the output. So over the winter of 1898, Raphael Jr. traveled down to the Black Mountains in North Carolina to build a kiln with his father to experiment with making their own custom tiles. And they had some success with making tiles, but however, the vast majority of their projects were still up in New England, and so they ran into problems with transportation, trying to get these tiles that were being made down in the South up to New England. So his accountant of their company came up with the idea, why don't we build a tile factory up in New England, which they did outside of Boston in Massachusetts. And they created, this was in 1900, they created a tile factory in an old wooden church that they were able to acquire. And so for the first time here, making their own tiles, they were able to control the entire process from the extraction of the clay from the ground all the way through to the construction of the vaulting. So they were able to really control the quality of the product from start to finish. We're seeing an example here of one of his tiles that were made. And along with this, because the goal was to kind of try to control the quality and create a consistency, resulted in a standardization. This being kind of a standard Guastavino tile, which generally measures 6 inches in width, 12 inches in length, and about an inch thick. So a couple years later, after they got their tile factory up and running up in outside of Boston, they received the commission for the City Hall subway stop in New York City in 1903. And this subway stop was an opportunity, much like in Boston with the public library, was an opportunity to really showcase the variety of tiles that they could create. As you see here, example, the green glaze variations, just to create a modeling, a subtlety of color across here as opposed to more stark contrast. A few more pictures of this. Quite stunning. This stop actually is no longer in service. Kind of looks like this. They have guided tours that will take you there. And so along those lines, question came up a week or two ago regarding this structure here in Pittsburgh, the Union Station that we're familiar with, or I guess it's referred to as the Penn Station, by Daniel Burnham, the architect that designed this. And this was created in 1900, so it's around the same time period. And I bring this into the lecture. This is not one of Guastavino's works, but I bring this in just to show as an example. The tile work that we're seeing here on the inside surface is an enameled terracotta. These pieces in here are all terracotta pieces that are enameled in the firing, as well as you can see the leaded glass oculus in the center. And so if you look at the drawings that were created for the construction of this, you can see information here that kind of speaks to the way that it's built, and also is kind of it for the investigators trying to figure out, is this one of Guastavino's works? There's clues within the drawings that you can see. For example, this down here on the ground, this is the dome here in the turnaround at the front of the station. And on the ground surface, you can see layers here where he's got brick called out, brick that's stood up vertically on its end, brick that's a second course below that that's laid flat. And then below that, he's got here called out 4.5-inch brick vault. The architect has the spring line drawn in of where that vault springs from, where it starts and springs up. And so you can tell by the dimension of this spring line, it's a very shallow arc. This is the ground floor level. There's a lower level below it. And the fact that this, in this case, it's called out as brick as opposed to tile. Traditionally, we've been seeing in the drawings where Guastavino's work is called out as a tile. This brickwork here, which is also a thicker brick than a standard Spanish thin brick, it's 4.5-inch, it's more of an English style brick. But the fact that this vault is the ceiling of the lower level is a very common thing that we see in his buildings. Generally, that lower level vault in the basement is something that's not seen by the public, so builders generally want to do that the least expensive ways that they can, which was one of the advantages of Guastavino's vaulting. So we see that it's being used down here. And in addition to that, the larger structure, actually here's the closer up, you can see it. And in between these layers of brick, the brick on edge, the brick laid flat on its face, and then the 4.5-inch brick arch, there's two layers of sand. And so they're kind of, they're using the sand loosely as kind of the binder between the layers. Obviously, this is something different completely than a cement that sets up and dries and cures. So this is almost kind of like a dry laid type paver, the way that this is being put in. But when we look at the adjacent structure next to the turnaround, which is the multi-story building, we see here sections through those floors. where, like, for example, the sixth floor level here, which would then be the ceiling of the fifth floor below it. And we can see that it's called out for the same type brick arch here that's spanning between the steel beams. Again, it's a thicker single course of brick, the 4.5-inch brick, but it's a single course. They're putting some concrete above that as a filler. Then here they're filling in a tile arch. So they're making a distinction between brick and tile that then translates up into the wood strips and wood flooring as the finished flooring surface on the floor level. Lower down here, interestingly enough, this is called out as a vaulted floor, and it's showing multiple layers here. So there's some similarity in the techniques, and to the point where it's this technique that Guastavino was bringing over, as he was using this method, and other builders would see this method, see it going up, they would learn the method. So a lot of times they would use it. This was why he was so urgent for him to try to patent his techniques, to try to prevent other builders from taking his techniques and using them. So here we see a slight variation off of Guastavino's work, but this also could be a combination of things. It could be that they're trying to avoid patent infringement. It could be a scenario where this was in 1900. This predates any of Guastavino's work in Pittsburgh. And so it might have just been a matter of that Pittsburgh had, or Guastavino hadn't come to town yet. A combination of things. But nevertheless, what we see kind of as the end result, something that looks very similar to what we've been looking at, the very flat, shallow dome. The nature of these coffers in the center here, the oculus. And in the coffers in particular, we see here, this is a drawing from Guastavino that came out much later in the 1920s, but he's showing a cross-section here of his multiple layers of tile that he puts in and to create the same kind of coffered interior that you're seeing on the interior of the dome, much to what we just saw in the Union Station. So he's trying to replicate this kind of dimensionality, this coffered detail as far as the decor, but do it through tile as opposed through a much heavier material like the terracotta that we're seeing in the Union Station. And that in particular is the point, is that the Union Station was built with stone, large pieces of granite for the structural arches, as well as all of that terracotta that we're seeing on the surface is very labor intensive to create, very heavy material relative to the thin tiles. So much more costly method of construction, which is what Guastavino is trying to circumvent with his methods. And so speaking of his methods, around 1905, this process that he's been using, which he's bringing over again from his homeland back in Spain, is starting to arrive at a four-step process that becomes much like his bricks that he's trying to standardize. The method he's also trying to standardize. Very simply, the first layer that he lays down, he binds the edges of the bricks together with a plaster of Paris, which is a very fast-setting mix of cement that will set up generally about 15, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, that it'll become pasty to where it'll have enough adhesion to hold the tile in place. It won't be completely cured, but it's further enough along that the tile can be in place, you can add another. Then the second layer comes along, added on top of the first layer. When the second layer comes on, they use a Portland cement in between the two layers. Now that the bottom layer has set up with this fast-setting cement, it now becomes a scaffold or a bridge for the second layer to sit on top of it. It's set up enough to hold the weight of the tile as well as the wet cement. And so it's there basically to hold it in place until that Portland cement can dry, which takes much longer than the plaster of Paris. The Portland cement, generally about a 24-hour period, before it sets up and starts to cure, not fully cure, but sets up enough to where the tiles don't move around. And so in which case, then once that 24-hour period has happened, you come back and he's applying a third layer on the underside as opposed to on top. And this is to completely sandwich in this original layer, which is the weak link because of the fact that you've got this plaster of Paris, which is a much weaker cement. And so now he's got two layers of the Portland cement sandwiching in between three layers of tile. And then finally the fourth step is he comes in on the underside and he adds additional mortar in his joints that he squares off to make kind of his signature look. And this is, again, because the tile is going to be the finished surface, so he's kind of dressing it up to make it look finished as opposed to just rough. And so that's the significance of putting that mortar on the underside as opposed to on the top side where it's not seen, it's not necessary. So this brings us to one of his first structures here in Pittsburgh, which is Porter Hall that we're familiar with here on campus. And you can see here a cross-section through the original building, through the hallway down through the center, and you can see the timbrel arches called out, and an example of these arched vaults down through the hallway, as well as periodic beams that the vaults span between that's built up of three layers of the tile to create the beam. Here we are looking down through the hall. You can see that the beam layer is laid linearly. He's staggering the joints, so like the layer up above the lower layer, the joint splits, so that way the joints are not stacked. And the same thing is done with the field vaulting, where he would stagger those joints as well. A little bit closer look. And so again, this is one of his first vaults here in Pittsburgh. You can see this is in 1908, so it's a few years after that technique of the three layers we just went through. It's a few years after that, so it's well established at this point as the way he's laying his tiles. And so you can see the raised mortar indicating the fact that it's laid that way, and also just the nature of the tile itself being this glazed with the striations, very uniform, clearly intended to be a brick that's for decoration. If we look at the overhangs on the exterior of the roof, the soffits, we can see where it's called out. Again, the Guastavino arch here, where the tiles are laid in to create the curvature of the soffit that we're seeing here in the photograph. You can see the tiles that are exposed as a finished material. Here's a plan, reflected plan, looking up at the tiles from underneath, called out again. Quite dramatic. Not only just the coloration in strong contrast to the white beige standard brick, but you also see the coloration variation in the tiles themselves. And that's intentional. It's early on, it might be a case where a darker brick is a brick that was overfired or underfired, and because of prior to him making his own bricks, there was issues with getting enough supply. They might have had just made do with that, but that aesthetic kind of grew to where now they're intentionally kind of creating that look, just to give some variation to the field of the material. And then also one other point here, you can see in this section also on the same building, it's calling out the timbrel tile, three layers, you can see, as well as this bracket piece down here below that's being placed in, supporting it, which we can see in the photograph here. So the vault itself is not only springing from the building to the outside soffit, but also between these brackets. And then also I wanted to show an elevation of this. This is Hornbostel, his work. Just to point out that the detail of the drawing, just exquisite nature of showing the tile on the roof, All the detail, the outlining just reads very clearly and very easily, something that's quite rare in today's practice. Guastavino Sr., that's down in North Carolina, would occasionally make trips back up north to visit with his son, the projects that are going on. But frequently when he would do this, he would catch up with some of his architectural friends that were based up in New England, such as White, Stanford White, McKim, Mead and White, the architectural firm that got him the commission for the Boston Library. Him and White became very good friends over the years, and they would frequently meet up at Madison Square Garden that we're seeing here, which was like a nightclub venue at the time. But this meeting was cut short in 1906. Some of you might be familiar. There was a scandal where this gentleman here, who was from Pittsburgh, he was a billionaire playboy by the name of Harry Thaw, and his wife, Evelyn, that we're seeing here, Nesbitt, who was a she was a showgirl, silent film actress, and so he shot White at the garden, accusing him of soiling his wife years prior. And so this, after this event, Guastavino made much fewer trips up north and stayed down in North Carolina. And he kind of retreated it to the wilderness, so to speak, where he started work on what became kind of his masterwork, which is the Basilica here of St. Lawrence, which is down near the estate, the Biltmore estate that he was working on in Asheville, North Carolina. This was in the Spanish colonial style, very similar to what you would find back in Barcelona. This is the dome on the interior, elliptical in shape. Generally speaking, just one of the best examples of his tile technique that he's been working on. This measures 58 feet in width and 82 feet in length. And no wood or steel was used anywhere in this construction. It's all completely tile. The walls, the ceiling, the floors, stairs, all the vaulting is completely using this technique. So it's really just kind of showcasing his life's work. He also not only oversaw the construction of this, but he also donated all the material and the labor for this. So it was kind of like a work of... around this time, their business was just taking off so strongly that they ended up expanding their factory that was making the tile into a second, larger building that we're seeing here, the Guastavino Jr. up in outside of Boston created this. This was in 1906. 1907, I think, is when they finally got their first kind of run of bricks out of this. So this is just about 7 years after the first factory. Here's an interior shot of the lobby coming in. And again, the entrance way is kind of like a showroom to kind of show off their wares to anyone that's coming into the factory on a tour of their tiles and their techniques.
Does that still exist?
It does. And in the entryway on the floor, kind of a broken mosaic, which is something that we don't see too much in Guastavino's work, but they've got his signature across the floor and his three-layered shallow arch, kind of like his motto here. So in 1908, February of 1908, Guastavino Sr. passed away, and unfortunately before he could complete his basilica that he was making down in North Carolina. So Raphael Jr. traveled down to North Carolina to complete the main altar in the church, as well as also a side chapel within that we're seeing here off to the side within the basilica. And this really was kind of like something that he did to in dedication to his father, who was also laid inside the crypt of the basilica. But the tile work in here, the ornamentation, quite exquisite and really far exceeding anything that they had done prior. So this was not only an opportunity for him to really push himself in the quality of the work, but also to an opportunity to also put out there what could be done or what was possible with their methods. So this was 1908 that he passed away. 1909, Raphael Jr., now out on his own, without his father, receives the commission that we talked about previously here to St. John the Divine in New York City. And at this point, this is a little bit after. You can see the scaffolding here on the vaults between the four main arches, these arches being in stone. He was tasked with filling in the four corners and then building the dome over top. And in particular, you can see here in this photograph, this is a figure down here for scale, but you can see these lines, the vertical lines here that are going around, and then you can see a very small plank at the very leading edge of this dome that's being built up. All this is the tile that's being built up to close in this dome at the top. This was a method that he had developed of creating a planking that they would, a work surface that they would work off of, referred to as like a movable centering rig or attachment that each day could be shifted out and moved as they add to the tile. Each day on average they would gain about 18 inches or three layers of brick out closing in the circle. And so this rig that they work off of platform is kind of just attached on to that the work from the prior day, and it's just being shifted as they work their way closer in. And as a result of this, a lot of the masons or the crew had talked amongst themselves, and they were placing bets on how soon it would collapse, because they didn't have much faith in this kind of movable system being attached to the work from the prior day, being secure enough to where a disaster was inevitable. And so, despite the fact that they never had a fatality on this project or a collapse, this created quite a nervousness within Guastavino Jr., just worrying about this. And so it's during this time that he tried to find ways to kind of like get away from the work and relieve some of his anxiety and stress. He met his future wife, who was the daughter of the owner of the boarding house that he was staying in Brooklyn when he was in New York. And they would spend times strolling in Brooklyn at Prospect Park, as well as going out to candlelight dinners, going to the theater. Quite often they had a box reserved at the theater for themselves. But he also, one of the things he liked to do on first couple dates, he took her up to the top of the dome so that way she could look down from above and get kind of that vantage point. So with the business thriving as a result of this dome, because it was quite a sensation. There was looker-ons that would come by daily just to watch the work being done. It was just, the scale was just so impressive. It really cemented his name. And so about a year after he started work on this, he took his newfound bride and went on a trip down to Mexico. To travel around to many of the historic masonry domes that you could find down there. One of which we're seeing here is the Cathedral of Puebla. And this one in particular is as you can see, is a study of just the color and the rendition of the tile. A year later, after this trip down to Mexico, he took a trip to Europe over the Christmas of 1911. 1911 was the kind of the date they were trying to complete the dome for the church in New York. And so, generally speaking, the winter is usually the slow time of the year. So that's the time when you can kind of get away from the job. And so most likely he was trying to celebrate the fact that he accomplished this great feat in New York with the dome. And he traveled to Spain, his homeland that he had come from as a very young child. And as well as he went to Paris, Egypt, Italy, Rome, again, to see all of kind of the great masterworks that he had read about and heard about, had not seen in person, trying to visit these places to learn from them, learn from the masters of the past for his own work. In particular, he also visited in Valencia and Madrid two tile factories to study their methods as well.
Real quick, just to note, the cathedral in Puebla, the date for that shocked me. Manuel Tulsa, the Puebla of Mexico, 1575.
Right.
So the first sort of got an awe in here when we saw the picture of the inside of that.
Right.
So the date of 1575, I thought was
quite impressive.
Notable.
Absolutely. Thanks for pointing that out. This basilica here, as far as the date, was from 1667. This is in Valencia, Spain. Again, elliptical dome here on top. As you can see, decorated. Certainly there's no tile here that's creating this dome exposed as a finish. This is very common back in Spain. On this trip over to Europe, I'll read a little passage here from a letter that his wife wrote back to one of her friends in the States. She said, to see Rome in limited time is the biggest proposition in the world. We are 5 days behind schedule and anxious to catch up, but there's so much to see and we would hate to miss anything. We were booked on the maiden trip of the Titanic, but we see that she has made her maiden trip earlier than expected and is already at sea. However, her schedule calls for her to return in time. We expect to depart on her planned trip from Cherbourg. It's just as well as we are missing the maiden voyage because the special tips expected would have busted us entirely. As it is, I will arrive looking like a tramp as I am seeing my spring Paris outfit fade in the distance with our diminishing funds. So quite faithful that they missed their boat that left early. They did make it back to the States. We're seeing here the Oyster Bar in New York City, some of you might be familiar with, near Grand Central Station. This was a commission in 1912. This is a use of a very reflective tile, visually as well as acoustically. As a result of this commission, he started to consider how to make tiles more audibly quiet, as we spoke about last week, less lively, because the fact that you've got so much hard surface here and no place for the sound to escape. The same year, 1912, he created the what we're seeing here, the Vanderbilt Hotel bar, that restaurant, and the tile work has gone even further than what we just saw in the Oyster Bar, where he's showing off this ornamentation, a variety of three-dimensional tile, as well as reflective specialty pieces, custom shapes and patterns. In particular, I'll point out his kind of
stereotypical herringbone here. He's the striations. He's created a
pinwheel type texture to it, just to add variety. And quite the palette as far as tile work. This brings us back here to Pittsburgh with Doherty Hall. I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with the terracotta overhangs at the roof line.
Did he do those?
So the terracotta tiles he didn't make, but he installed the vaulting that's beneath them that supports them. And then Machinery Hall, as it was called, or today Hamschlag Hall. We can see the mix of his standard tile here in the field, as far as in the vaulting and between the ribs of the terracotta moldings. All of this dimensionality, trying to create an aesthetic that's more dynamic visually as well as sculpturally. We can see here a drawing, again, this Hornbostel that's showing how this is attached and held onto the building. You can see the outline of the terracotta, which is a very kind of thin material that's cast with concrete behind it. And it's when that concrete, so then the terracotta almost becomes a mold that the concrete's poured into. And when it's poured into that, they place a copper pin or wire into that concrete. So when the concrete cures and sets up, it now has a copper wire piece that they can bring back and hook into the larger structure behind it of the building to hold it in place. And then also the main entry vault here, you can see, again, you can see his vaulting called out that's supporting the main vault. As well as the drawing. Again, pointing out just the skill level of the drawing, you can see in perspective this terracotta rib that's going down and coming at you creates this true sense of a three-dimensional form on two-dimensional paper. In elevation, the same thing. You can see the drawing technique quite impressive. And again, called out here, the Guastavino in the field, with the terracotta rib and then the Guastavino infill. This brings us to Baker Hall. This is in 1913. Again, much like we saw with the others on in this quad here, the terracotta overhangs. But in the original drawing, something that you might not be familiar with, a more classical style entablature appendative here, where this figure drawing was going to be created in relief in stone, limestone, to kind of show off the work of what is being done here by Carnegie. And even you can see the city and the bridges here. But basically kind of tells the story or the narrative of the point or the purpose of this institution that he's creating. As it turns out, this was omitted. You can actually see here, omit carvings. Once they came up with the design, they, for some reason or other, changed their minds, maybe for budget reasons. But in any event, ended up with brick as a very simple kind of toned down approach as opposed to the more decorative, but significant. You can see the layering here in the detailing to create this this layering of brick, and by toning it down and just going with the brick itself becoming the feature is something that this entryway at Baker becomes significant. The way that he's layered the tiles for the ribs to create this shadow line, to create this kind of dimensionality to the surface. He's really kind of giving you kind of an insight, showing you how these things are stacked by kind of feathering them out
layering them in.
You almost kind of, it's almost kind of like giving you an understanding of how this thing is put together. And then closer up, look at the tile. We see here now, again, same traditional scored raised joints, but here much cleaner than what we saw in Porter Hall, just down, literally down the hall from this structure. This is being put up roughly about 5 years later, but in that 5 years time, you can see his technique has gotten a lot much more refined. On the exterior, again, you know, this very clean, strong line, shadow line that's created by the raised mortar joints.
The entryway drawing here that you can see coming in. Again, his vaulting that's called out for the side arches.
And here you can see in section, you can see the figure here that's sitting in the center of that relief that was omitted. Called out as the carved limestone. This brings us to Margaret Morrison. This side piece over here, in addition to the very ornamental overhangs of the soffits, we see the same type of work that's coming in, filling in not only the around the band, but also the columns themselves. And you can see the underside, his vaulting, in a very pale color, colored in contrast to the white, but also the very subtle mutations in the color from tile to tile. Very kind of refined and sophisticated palette. And then one last example here, Hamburg Hall, which at the time was referred to as the U.S. Bureau of Mines. This is 1916. And here, wood on the underside, very stark contrast to the other buildings around in the very ornamental terracotta. A note here, in one of his, this is one of his drawings that was taken from one of his advertisements about in the 20s, 1926, I believe. But you can see a note here, he's calling out a harmonizing of color of buff and gray with contrasting colors as inserts. And so you can see here that a notation of this color variation is not a random or by chance. It's clearly intentional, where he's using buff and gray, two colors that are very complementary and very subtly in variation. With a stronger contrasting color used less frequently as to build some interest and variation. And so we're seeing that here on the inside of the entryway into this building. And you can see again that buff and gray color tiles, as well as a few contrasting darker tiles dropped in to create, again, this mottled kind of varied look to the surface.
The interior is also worth it.
What's that?
The inside of the Hamburg Hall is also extraordinary.
Absolutely. Yep. So with that, I'm going to take just a quick 5-minute break, and we'll resume here at 10 after. See if I can pull up something here on graphic statics.
Sounds like your microphone died. You didn't turn it off, I assume.
No, I just turned it off just now, though.
Yeah.
Maybe the battery's going.
Yeah, the battery's. Oh. Quick question. You keep saying these tiles are an inch thick.
Right.
I've taken some pictures.
Yeah.
I mean, it's literally
right.
Half inch thick.
Okay.
Most all the ones I've seen on Baker and
yeah.
Porter.
Yeah. So you'll see in the second half here, we're going to look at the City County building downtown, and with that, I've got some of his specifications, written specifications, that in the archives, And in that, it calls out where, in that particular building, they called out for seven eighth inch thickness.
Right.
So those thicknesses were definitely specified. And obviously, as you can imagine, you know, half inch as opposed to an inch, you're saving half the amount of material. So, you know, I would assume that would be at a lower cost. But generally speaking, the 1 inch is just kind of a rule of thumb.
Right. But when laminating,
right,
you know, having a bunch of thin layers is what gives you the strength as
that's right.
opposed to fewer thick.
That's right.
So I was just curious what you really used. Why don't you pull your mic off and I'll take it to the office.
Okay.
I'll get them to replace the batteries. Yeah, you got to pull the whole thing.
Did he do the fine arts building here or
no? He did not.
Was that later or was that earlier?
It was. It wasn't later. It was in the same time period. It was by Hornbostel. Did the same.
Yeah.
But it. But Guastavino didn't have any work in that particular
okay.
building.
Okay. It's almost like they were attached at the hip.
That's right.
Wow.
The catalog. On the wall has an example.
Yeah, exactly. It's like fitting right. that it's in the room here. Whoever coordinated that was on top of it.
How are you? I'm pretty. How are you? Okay.
This is our last one. What are you making?
Oh, just a scarf.
A sweater?
Scarf.
Oh, a scarf.
No, I just.
Okay. Just keep this, keep the hands going. Keep and also it has to match shoes.
Not really, because it's not for me.
No.
Thank you.
I just keep doing these things, trying to use a leftover yarn because
right.
I've got a stash that will outlive me. And if I only had, you know, small amounts of something, I just put the scarf and put it to the freestyle ground.
Oh.
So those of you who might be interested in the graphic statics, I'll give you a real quick insight on this. This is goes back to Antonio Gaudi's work back in Barcelona, and he developed this. Study model that he created, which you can see if you go to visit his work in Barcelona. There's a model, an actual model that's in his main work. You may be familiar with Sagrada Familia. In the lower basement level, they've got, I think, a scale model that's a replica of the one that he created when he was designing. Not only the Sagrada Familia, but also the work prior to that, which was kind of like the study that he did that led to it. And so this technique that he used, he used hanging chains. And so he would take, for example, he would take a chain here, and he would hang it from two points. And so when you hang a chain from two points, it naturally just drapes to a profile that gravity pulls on it naturally. And so then if you take those two points, you take those same chain, and now you add a third intermediate point where you bring a chain in, you grab the center here, and you pull up on it and support it at this third point. Now you have, again, gravity's pulling down on it. And so now this profile has changed and adjusted by having this third point pull on it. And then also, you note here that if you take that center point, and you shift it and move it from one point, the profile will adjust and change. And then move it even further. You can see from here to here that the bottom profile is changing, as well as also even just the center support here. Here, the center in between these two, the line is coming straight down. But here, where it's off center between the two points, the line is actually a slight angle, and that inclination is the whole point of why he created this model, was to study. Not only was he trying to figure out a way graphically without calculations of mathematics, but to graphically figure out what this profile is, as well as what the angles of the supports that are supporting that profile. Because then what he would do is he'd take this and he would invert it
So if you can imagine, you take that arc and you flip it up, right? So now these become the arch profiles of his arch that he's going to use to create his structure. And here you can see that angled support, this column that's coming up and supporting. These two vaults are coming together at this point, and then this column is supporting that vault. And so, generally speaking, you can see these two vaults are different sizes. They're asymmetrical, they're not symmetrical vaults. And because he's got one larger vault and one smaller vault coming together, figuring out how the interaction of all these load paths coming off these two vaults of different sizes to this point, and how you get that load down to here to the ground, the trick is figuring out where that load naturally wants to go. If you were to put in a straight column vertically, then that column over time, because this is a larger load, larger vault, it's pushing that in this direction more so than this vault is pushing back. And so if you put up a straight column over time, that column's gonna start to lean and want to kind of fall over. And so if you incline the column to where the base is out this way, it's kind of, the column's wanting to fall this way, it's actually kind of pushing back on this vault to create a balance. And so the trick is, through this model that he's creating, that we're seeing here, is that by inverting his design and creating it upside down and letting the change just naturally hang from gravity, what he discovered is that the path of gravity pulling on the chain, creating those angles, is the exact same thing that you're gonna get when you invert it. The gravity that's pulling down on the weight is the exact same reverse pushing back up as when it's free hanging. And so this was a graphical way that you could study the load path without doing calculations, mathematics that modern engineers use today. And more interestingly enough is that at the time that Gaudi was doing his work, another development was coming along, photography, which was this new medium. And so he took advantage of this. He would take his models, design them upside down, and since they're made of chains, you can't turn them over because then the chains all move around. So he would take a photograph of the model, then he would just turn the photograph over. And so then he could take that photograph and he could then use that to get measurements directly off the photograph to find out exactly how long is this column, how much is it offset, and all, you know, the radii of the various vaults, all this could be then used to study or to build his structures then directly off of this, again, this graphic method. I'll show you one other real quick point about this, which is really fascinating, is that these points, if you take, let's see here, if you stack this is what's called the vector of the force. So you got this vector here, you got a second vector, he's got a label here, 3, 2, 1. You got a second one here and another one here. And so if you take these vectors, which is like this reaction one here, you got this one vector that comes up this way. And let's see here, take a minute to get back into this. You got this second one here. So this angle, this vector, is the same angle that's translated here. This angle that's coming up is the same angle that's translated here. The third vector here is the same angle. So the angles are the same. The length of the angle is based, or the length of the vector is based on the amount of load that's being placed on it. And so when you have a uniform load across the top that's being placed down on top of this, each one of these segments has, you know, a portion of that load that's coming on it. So if you add up those loads, you can get the length of the vector. And then if you put them tail, tip to tail, they call it, one after the other, you come back around and you get to this point. And then if you get to your end point and you come back to the origin point, you can close out the circle, which then tells you that the structure is stable. But in this case, you can see that he's coming back here with this one and this one here, two separate ones. So he can actually find out how much of this vault is being carried on this load here. He can calculate out the total load on that vault and the total load here on the smaller vault separately. So let's see if I
Let me see if I have, I might have a picture. So this was the model that Gaudi created for the design. And you can see each one of these chains, he puts a little bag on it, which is a weight laden with lead pellets. And so those pellets, these bags are basically, he would add weight to it depending on how much load he wants to place on each point. And he would go through, and this the brilliance of this model is that if you change the weight, say, of this bag right here, because this is all free-hanging chains, as you add more weight to this or take weight off, the adjacent chains that this weight is attached to is going to adjust based on that movement. And as that adjusts, it adjusts everything. And so it trickles down through the entire model, makes those little increment changes. So it becomes like a calculating machine that calculates and readjusts all the angles of each one of these columns, as well as the lengths, the shape of the arch, all of that as he's designing and working on the design is kind of doing those calculations for him manually, again, graphically, without calculating through numbers and formulas that we use today. So back to Guastavino. This is the site for the city county building, which was 1916. A couple photographs that were taken, set up during the construction. You can see them starting to by force dig out the foundations, and then laying up some of the steel columns to create the frame for the building as it goes up. And then now we can start to recognize the entry to it, the columns here, creating the front loggia where we're going to find Guastavino's work. And then once the building's up, the skin, the stone on the face is kind of being applied to the steel structure that's creating the support. And once that's closed in, you can see here, again, stone on the exterior, his tile work coming along on the interior of the main loggia. Again, very decorative shapes. He's creating here. He's getting into some original new forms, circular pie shaped forms that we're seeing here. Even the field work, he's doing a different type of alternating pattern, which. Just a little bit closer up here. You see some of the striations in some of the tiles. Again, the vaults spanning between the stone ribs. And so it's what we talked about last week, a pendentive vault, coming back to the four corner points, load paths. And so this is a record here of the budget for the project. You can see each one of the trades kind of listed here, the name of the contractor as well as the work trade that they did. We can see here number 17, Guastavino and Company, did the timbrel arches. And you follow us along here, you can see their final cost was $16,527 for that entry loggia that we just saw. And I bring this up to point out that if we go up here to the top, we find the structural steel, which is the frame of the building, that was $201,000. We go to the granite, the stone that's supporting the exterior, $236,000. The granite, they've got actually two separate contractors working on the granite, so $236 and $106 for $350 roughly. Fireproofing, if you recall back from our earlier lecture, where a large part of his tile was the fact that it was fireproof. Here, this is being done by a separate contractor.
$144,000 compared to his $16,000. Cement work, another $155,000. Ornamental iron work, $112,000. So you can see, relatively speaking,
How much of a savings his method was in delivering this.
Also pulled from the specifications. This is the written specifications along with the drawings that would go for creating a building. The architect would write out in writing, specifically in narrative, calling out how the materials and the installation is to occur. And so here we see under the category for tile, which would apply to Guastavino. We see here it says all tile used for the work under this contract shall be sound, hard burned, semi-porous terracotta tile, 7/8 inch thick, 6 inches wide by 12 inches long. And then they're breaking it down here further into three different options that they hadn't decided yet when the spec was written. They have a tile bid A, which could be accepted as an unglazed, finished, smooth, without ribs. Color to be selected. There's a bid B, which should be a sound, hard, burned, semi-porous terracotta tile and shall have a glazed finish on rib bed surface of texture and color to be selected. And then a third option here, which is that all tiles should be sound, hard, burned, semi-porous terracotta tile with a matte glazed finish, a similarly ribbed surface of a color to be selected by the architect. So you can see here that the architect is specifically calling out what they want in the finished product. In this case, the city county building, that loggia, those colors, those tiles were not to be selected and decided by Guastavino. It was something that was being specifically called out by the architect. And then you can also see here is a change order, very common in the industry. To where a decision is changed in the process. Here it's changed the timbrel tile arches in Grant and Ross Street loggias. And so more than likely, that color or texture that they decided on, they made a change to, which resulted in an increase in cost of $1,000 to the original contract. Which you can also see down here signed by Rafael Guastavino Jr. This brings us to the University Club. This is a drawing some of you might be familiar with on Pitt's campus. The down in this corner here is an exterior loggia, which is very similar to some of the buildings we've been looking at. Here in plan, you can see the loggia as well as a section through that space. This is on the exterior of the building. There's a kind of a procession hall here that leads to it from the interior. This is a structure that's no longer exists today. Here's an exterior shot. In place of that loggia is now this new entry point that's located here. So this is the fate of some of his work has come down over time from renovations, changes, this type of thing. Despite the fact that between him and his father, they created over 1,000 works across the country, none of them to date have fallen of their own accord as a structural failure, but several of them, many of them have come down intentionally. We can see here inside the library of the University Club, you can see his vault here in the ceiling that still remains. In a plaster finish, very traditional for the Spanish style. And this brings us to, this is a structure in New York City I wanted to point out. This is Penn Station, which is, again, another structure by McKim, Mead, and White, his friend, Mr. White. This was a commission that Guastavino was awarded in 1910. You can see his vaulting here that's coming down and it's supported by a steel frame. So it's the kind of the marrying together of this masonry and steel structure, kind of showcasing this steel in its raw form, much the same way the tile is being showcased. So it's kind of very, a very kind of brutal exposure of the material, but it's speaking to this vocabulary of these new materials of steel, concrete, glass, that are coming along at this turn of the century. And here the architect is trying to showcase that and set it apart. But the reason I point this out was because just about 50 years after the construction of this, it was demolished, 1963. And one of the architectural historians, Vincent Scully, I'll read here, made a comment about it being taken down. He said, "One entered the city like a god. One scuttles in now like a rat." He's referring to the fact that this Penn Station was one of the major arteries coming into the city. And as you can see, the splendor and the visual impact, which now Penn Station in New York, if you're familiar with, has basically come in at lower kind of ground level underneath, scurrying in like a rat. But this building, when it came down, after it came down and they realized how much they lost, this sparked a movement of preservation of architecture. And this is really kind of like the start of the architectural preservation moment as a result of this building. That brings us to another one of Glossovino's works. This one here is the Western Theological Seminary. This was in 1915 on the north side. This is the vaulting that he did was renovated by the Community College of Allegheny, which now occupies the building. Here's the renovation that they did, very modernized, but obscuring the vaulting work of his vault. Still there, but not visible. This brings us to B'nai Israel Synagogue, 1924. You can see the shape and the form of the dome on top kind of speaks to one of Glossovino's Spanish-style domes. But if we look at the plans, we find out that the dome is actually framed, not of tile. In this case, it's actually a wood frame as opposed to steel, which is quite surprising. You can see on the exterior, some of that wood frame is starting to get exposed. From just the neglect of maintaining it, the deterioration, even this cladding material here on the face, which was innovative at the time. And then we go inside here, we can see, for aesthetic reasons, this cloth fabric that's draped on the underside to make almost like a tent structure as the underside of this dome space. So we have this wood frame structure and a secondary dome structure on the interior made of fabric. And we see what we see in some of the other structures, these kind of flying buttresses that are supporting this interior kind of arcade around the perimeter, that in wood as well. And so we have to go to the exterior of the building, to this front portico, to find Glossovino's contribution to the building. The vault on the main entry exterior here, you can see it's a simple barrel vault in one direction, but a mixture of materials. It's got the stone arch that we've been seeing. And also in particular, you can see also this ornamental ironwork here that's running across the bottom at the spring line. This is doing some structural work. It's creating a tension to resist kind of the lateral thrust that's created by the arch. And so we've got this mixture of stone, metal, and tile to create this structure here. We also see decoratively this mosaic tile work, which is also in states of disrepair. The tile, this mosaic was not part of Glossovino's work, but pointed out because some of you might be familiar with Gaudi, his broken mosaics. If we go back over to Barcelona for a moment here. Since we're talking about tile with Glossovino, I thought we'd point out some of the other decorative tile here that we find here in Pittsburgh. Also significant in the same synagogue is some glasswork that came in the 1960s by a glass artist. This is some of the best examples of stained glass you'll find in Pittsburgh.
very modern, contemporary, abstract, but also significantly similar style to the tile that you see with Guastavino as far as the modeling of color, the variation, also just the roughness. Here, what makes this particular artist significant is he puts as much attention to the joints or the grout as he does to the glass. The joint or the grout becomes as figurative and stylistic as the glass itself, the shape of the glass. And so, as an example here, you get a piece of glass that kind of becomes a figure within a field of grout. This, fortunately, is in the process. This building is being renovated, and the glass is being preserved.
What are they going to do with it?
I don't think it's been completely set. The plan is that they're trying to use it as a multifunctional facility. I think it's going to be like a community center, as well as I think they're going to try to get some housing in there as well. As well as like office space, this type of thing, a mixture. This brings us to the Allegheny County Courthouse, which originally was designed back in the 1800s, 1888, by Richardson, one of the most well-known architects to do some work here in Pittsburgh. But Guastavino came along in 1924. We see here some of his vaulting from the side entrance, which is very apparent, very recognizable. Down in the lower level, though, you can see here quite large from the arch beams that we've been seeing previously. Here we're seeing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 layers of tiles, twice the number that you would normally find. And this is precisely because this is at the lower level, the amount of load of this stone structure above it, multi-story, is being placed down on top of this. And so here, this hallway, if you recall back to the Porter Hall, that had just the beams just 2 layers thick. Here we've got 6 to carry the load path just for the width of this hall that's actually narrower than the Porter Hall. There's a closer up detail here of the tile. And again, the tile itself, modeling in slight variations in tone and color. This is also happens to be that acoustolith tile that we mentioned last week, which is the tile that he developed to deaden the sound, to make the space quieter. If we work our way up from the lower level, this is up to the main main level entry, the vaults, which are not his work. And then if we look at a cross section here, this is this main entry that we were just looking at, the vaulting. His work is down here at the lower level. And this was because at one point, this was the main entrance into the building, and they lowered the street. And by lowering the street, they gained another level below. And so they lowered the building by doing so, creating a space. We could see, so at the main entry level here is up, elevated off of the street. You can see a few process shots of this project, which was at the time in the 1920s a little over $3 million for the budget, just to lower Grant Avenue, just a stretch. All of this done, as you can see here, by very kind of rudimentary mechanical machines and horses. This speaks to the mound. This is a section here through what they called the hump cut. And it was the hump that was in Pittsburgh, and the goal was to try to level it out for Branch Street. And the theory was that it was worth $3 million because it made it much easier to run streetcars down the street as opposed to going up and down the hills, as well as walking pedestrians. We see here in plan, you can see the Allegheny Courthouse here, the City County Building next to it. And you can see the elevations at each of these corners that was taken. So the height, 14.3, was right at the corner of the Allegheny Courthouse, was the main. And so this hill
extended over quite a few blocks of the downtown area.
Here's another survey.
You can see this is calling out the different types of soil that you're getting from the rivers, as well as the change. And again, this concentration here that's happening right around that area.
And just to kind of go back to the first lecture that we had in this class, where we looked at the earthworks, the mound in eastern Ohio, that this mound culture that was creating these forms was occurring back several thousand years ago, but these, generally speaking, followed the Mississippi, the Ohio, the river network was where these mounds would occur. And in particular, these mounds generally occur at the fork of where a river splits. And us being from Pittsburgh, we're very familiar with the Three Rivers, the Fork. This downtown triangle that we have is the location where, generally speaking, you will find these mounds occurring. And so there's some thought that this hump that they refer to as Grant's Hill historically might actually have been one of these mounds that was created from the mound culture. There's just a few architectural examples here of some of the indigenous dwellings.
And I just point these out because, again, it's creating the same arc that you have that Guasavino is trying to create, the same arc structure. Here they're doing it with different means, but what's curious is the fact that these cultures, very much separated, are still trying to achieve the same ends in very different ways.
So pulling us back here to Pittsburgh, this is the county office building.
The entryway into the county office. Again, the acoustolithic tile, which is the
sound-deadening tile. Also, you can see the very Gothic style architecture that we're familiar with, that we looked at a couple weeks back in a lot of the churches around Pittsburgh. Again, the stone ribs with the infill of the vault with the tile. And then if you go down the hall in the same building, you can see an example of the floor system from floor to floor being the same vaulting, low, shallow vaulting between the columns that are supporting it. In this case, a recent renovation concealed all this vaulting that was exposed, plastered over it. But the profile is still there. And also in contrast here, we show, you know, kind of like our standard ceiling that we put in of other means, just to show, even in this case, you know, what we just looked at with the tile, this plaster is less appealing than the exposed tile, but even in this case, the plaster cover is much preferred to what we're seeing over here. Just another shot through here, through this office space. They've got this double, this atrium height with a balcony that runs the perimeter. And this brings us to Shadyside Presbyterian Church. This is a
large open central structure with a flat ceiling.
Here we can see the interior. This building Guastavino worked on.
I'm still trying to figure out where his work is in this building. I haven't been able to locate any drawings for this structure. I suspect he did the vaulting that supports the choir loft balcony here, but I don't know for certain. I've been kind of all through this building and I can't really find anything that really stands out. But I point this out because a lot of Guastavino's work has been kind of trying to discover or ferret out this information from the archives or the drawings that have been left behind that we heard about a couple weeks ago at Columbia University. But in this building, I wanted to show some of the mosaic tile work here, which is not his work, but is quite spectacular. Again, this goes back to this ancient style of tile work, using specific size pieces, ornament, color, to create figures. And this is something that Gaudi also
was familiar with, but when he introduced his broken mosaics is something that he was kind of reacting to. This is very labor-intensive, very costly form of tile work. So show a graph here. This is the tile production once they started with their first factory in 1900s. Then in 1906, they increased the size of their factory. This is their tile production was growing steadily. Peaked in 1915 at just under 900,000 tiles per year. And then from that, you can see that it drops off for a variety of reasons. Partly World War I came along, and so the demand for construction at the time was less. But I point this out because 1915 being the peak, this is when their work, in addition to tile production, was also at its peak. This is really kind of the high point of their work that's occurring. And fortunately, here in Pittsburgh, we have, like on CMU's campus, the works that we looked at here today, starting in 1908 through 15s into the 20s, we're getting samples of some of their best work at the peak. And so I wanted to end today's lecture on three examples of really probably the best examples of Guastavino's tile work that he did from this period. Also of note, after the 1915, when things started to fall off and commissions were coming fewer and fewer in, Guastavino, being the type of person that he is, took advantage of this downtime. And so he rigged up a portable pottery turntable and a kerosene kiln in his create a shop in his garage at his house. And he started to just turn out ordinary burned clay pieces and then experimenting with different types of glazes. And so this experimentation that he did during this time period, he was basically trying to imitate this ancient antique form of Persian glazing of tiles that you would see back in Europe around this region that he came from, this Spanish tile that had a very strong Persian influence. And so he was trying to kind of replicate and create this stuff to a level of degree of sophistication that these tiles that he created, which were just experiments at the time, many of them have ended up in the collections of the Metropolitan Museum in New York City. And so we see here three examples here in Pittsburgh of tiles that came out of those experiments. This first one being the Bell Telephone Company, which is downtown at along Strawberry Way. You can see a very reflective tile. He's experimenting with different types of glaze colors. This green hue, quite striking. All of this, the striations, the techniques we're familiar with, we've been looking at here over the last couple weeks. Again, you know, the ribbed vault beams, arches that are supporting the vault. And then actually, I took this picture yesterday. Just this, so here's the vault. Here you can see actually the glow of the green from the natural light that's reflecting off of the, not off of the street here. The sunlight's coming down and bouncing back up. But this color is complementary to the colors we just looked at in the tile. So this artist here that's doing this street mural, I kind of suspect was pulling their color palette a little bit in reference to this piece and their side here. A second example is the Allegheny General Hospital on the north side. This was in 1929. And this has a little bit more of that Persian flair that he was trying to replicate back in his experiments up in his kiln. Not only in the ornament, but also the tiles themselves, the shapes, and the color. Again, the terracotta cast ornament. And in particular, these tile, this trimming that he's doing around the perimeter here is a reflective tile, almost like a mirrored, a glaze that creates almost like a mirrored finish. You can kind of see the reflective quality here in the contrast between the darker and the lighter.
The headers on those columns were different.
These here?
Yeah. I don't know if that was his or not.
Yeah, no, well, this, again, in most cases, the design is being dictated by the architect. And like the Boston Public Library, the very first commission he got, he was given the latitude by his, who became his friend, to take some of that artistic license, because they wanted to kind of see what he could do once they realized that this guy had the ability. But that's not always the case going forward, that architects would give that kind of latitude to the contractor. It would only come usually after years of working with them and developing confidence and trust. And then finally, one last example, which is the U.S. Post Office and Courthouse. Which at the time was back in 1931, is now actually the entrance lobby to one of the federal agencies. I can't remember off the top of my head. But this is an exterior view from the street, right at 6th Avenue. And you can see through the glass the tile in the lobby here. I actually see a security guard coming out here telling me I can't take pictures. This is inside, right inside the lobby, and you can see, again, the tile work, you can see the modeling of the, but in particular, the gold metallic glaze that he's created in this case. Quite striking.
That was Junior at that time, right?
Yes. So all of the work in Pittsburgh is under Junior. Senior passed away in 1908. There's a few structures that were done prior to 1908 in Pittsburgh, and there's not any documentation that says the whereabouts of Senior when those structures were going up, so it's difficult to say whether he had any hand in them. I'm sure that some of the major commissions, like when he was involved with Carnegie, as well as Frick and the Mellons, I'm sure that Senior was involved in that, but as far as just at a minimum interaction with those individuals, but how much of an involvement he had in the actual construction is questionable. So it's a safe bet that pretty much everything we're seeing here in Pittsburgh is being done by Junior. And it's quite remarkable, because if you look in comparison between the works of Senior and Junior, in many ways Junior excels and exceeds the work of what Senior accomplished. And this is despite the fact that Junior never went through any kind of formal education. He basically was brought up as an apprentice to his father, learning the trade from, a hands-on type instructor. So that pretty much wraps up our lecture and our course for Guastavino's work.